I'm Joan Weaver, and we have Rosetta Graff, librarians from the Kinsley Public Library, and we're in the home of Daryl and Karen Miller. This interview, I guess that's all we need. Okay, Daryl, can you describe what your farm was like in 1979 at the time of the tractor came?
Well, in 1979, basically we ran a straight wheat operation.
How big was it?
Starting the first of the year, it wasn't very big. Karen's dad died, and I took over the ground that he'd been farming. And so we about doubled in size then, so we were probably looking at that time at about 2,000 acres, which sounds like a lot, but when you're summer fallow wheat farming, you're really only putting half of it in production, which amounts to about 1,000 acres. And we did not hire any outside help. Karen was my number one hired man, and my son, who was in high school then. And then a year or two after that, we expanded out. And at one time, we farmed over 3,000 acres. But in 79, we're looking, jumping from 1,000 to about 2,000. And I was not into row crop farming. And later on, I got into farming milo, to mainly for crop rotation. Operation part of the time.
What kind of tractors were you using, and how expensive were you? Were you buying new tractors? Or?
Well, compared to today's market, no, I never bought a new tractor in my life. Everything I ever owned was used. And probably the tractors that we were running at that time, right after her dad died, I had to buy another used one. It was somewhere around $11,400, which had a cab and an air conditioner on it. And that was about the time that price of all equipment was going up big time along in there. In fact, tractor probably didn't cost that much new, but on the used market, we went through some economic adjustments, so the price of used equipment was staying at a pretty good price.
And you didn't do any cattle there?
We did cattle for a little bit, but kind of the way the operation went was, my dad had quite a bit of pasture land, and I liked farming better than I did messing with the cattle, and I didn't have enough help. Which you really need help if you're going to run a year-round cattle operation. So I basically stayed with the dry land farming. My sister, my brother-in-law used the pasture land. So that's just the way it worked out, and probably was for the better.
Did you get your farmland from your father or original parents?
At one time I had 12 landlords. I farmed for 12 different people.
So you leased, or is that what they call it?
Not really. Operated on a one-third, two-thirds. In other words, they got a third of the crop. I had two-thirds of the crop. I stood a third of the fertilizer expense, herbicide expense, and I stood all the harvesting. Looking at five generations or almost four generations. Like everybody else's family, ours migrated out here from Ohio, Illinois. And my grandfather was actually the first person to grow hard red winter wheat in this county. Back, you know, in those early days, everybody was growing corn. That's what they knew how to grow because that's what they grew in Illinois, Ohio, wherever they came from. But his farm was over where my great-grandfather's farm was, about 2 miles east, about a mile and a half south of Belfry. But he was eldest in the family, and he went out and started making a living for the rest of the family due to the fact his father was ill and died. And he worked on a big wheat farm and cattle ranch between Belfry and Larned. It was called the Posey Farm. And this Mr. Posey kind of grub-staked him, got him started, and started buying land, and he went into planting wheat, and then later on he ran a thrashing machine crew, which is how he made his money, and he turned out to be very successful. He owned land all over western Kansas. eastern Colorado. And he liked partners. He always had partners in all his deals. My dad hated partners. He wouldn't partner with anybody. So that's kind of the background on the farming. And my mother's side of the family, the same way. They have been Irish immigrants, ended up in Ohio, Illinois. And that side of the family, great-grandfather was a track layer for the Santa Fe. And he was laying track. When they got to Ellenwood, he had the rest of the family come out there. And they actually had a little homestead north and east of Ellenwood before they came down to Edwards County. So we got farming on both sides of the road there.
Okay, well, was your farm the sole source of income for your family in 1975, or did you have to supplement it in any way? In 1979?
79?
Yeah.
Karen worked for Ralph across manufacturing, but that was pre-79. So basically, you know, we just depended on the wheat crop that we raised. And once in a while, I'd help people do a few things since I knew how to weld, and maybe I'd get a job helping build some cradle corrals or something like that. But that was the main source of revenue.
Okay, and then how did you become involved in the American agricultural movement? This is prior to the tractorcade. What's the history there of it in the county, and how did you become involved?
The first I heard about it would have been in the fall of 77, in like September, about the time I was starting to plant wheat. And I just heard him mention it on the tractor radio that there were some farmers in southeast Colorado, and they were talking about having a farm strike. Well, that's about the dumbest thing I've heard of for a while. And didn't pay much attention to it, but as the weeks went by, there kept being more things in the paper about it, and a little bit of coverage here and a little bit of coverage there. And so these guys in southeast Colorado were going out and just basically putting on informational meetings all over the state. And since it started in Springfield, Colorado, but naturally jumped right across the state line into Stanton County, Kansas, which is Johnson City, Ulysses. So the whole southwest part of Kansas really got involved in a hurry. And then it just slowly started migrating toward the center of the state, not only in this state, but it was going into all other states. And this was strictly a word-of-mouth operation. When these guys in Colorado decided they were going to do this, they just started calling everybody they ever knew or ever heard of, no matter where they lived, and telling them they had this idea. And it just took off from there. And the first time I ever went to anything where they were talking about it was down in the building down in the park, what we now call the 4-H building. And I can't even remember who conducted the meeting, but Karen's dad and I went, and just to sit and listen. I remember we got back afterwards and we sat around the kitchen table and both agreed this thing wasn't going anywhere.
Okay, now, was the American agricultural movement before 1978, or did it actually start in Colorado?
Started in the fall of 77.
In Colorado?
In Springfield, Colorado.
Oh, okay, that was the very beginning of it.
That was the hub. And Karen grew up in Springfield, Colorado, but a lot of those people we didn't even know until later on. We started comparing notes and found out she did know some of them. But that was the birthplace there. And really what started it all was some produce farmers up in that Rocky Ford area. I think it was mainly onions, produce that they had grown, and I mean they sold it to this wholesale buyer. And I can't remember what they marked it up. From out of the field into the store, it was like 200 or 300%. And these guys said, you know, this is ridiculous. We're growing this stuff. We're putting the work into it. All they're doing, we're sacking it, and it's going in the store, and they're marking it up 200 or 300%. You know, and that's kind of what kicked the thing off. But, you know, the timing was right. People were disgruntled with the fact that going through the Nixon era, we'd had a embargo on grain, the price on beef got frozen, and coming in after a new election, Carter had been elected, and what appeared to be on the horizon was a farm bill that was worse than what we had, which was nothing, and this new one was going to be worse than that. So that's kind of what sparked it off. And I really didn't get involved till, I would say probably late October, early November. And they have what they call a statewide organizational meeting in Great Bend.
What year is this we're talking about?
Okay, this would be in the fall of 77.
Okay.
And so just to satisfy my own curiosity, I went up there and sat down and listened to what they were talking about, what their ideas were, what they had in mind. And, you know, the whole emphasis was going to Washington, D.C. and putting together a major lobbying organization and trying to improve upon the farm bill that was already going to be in place. And that day, I'll never forget, the young guy that conducted the meeting was Lyle Davidson from Johnson, Kansas, who was a farmer, but he'd gone to Kansas University, majored in dramatics. But, I mean, he knew how to get up and run a meeting, and he was probably one of the few guys that could have done it and kept it under control. But next day, big headlines on the front of the Hudson paper: "We are not barnyard radicals." All those papers I had kept for years, and they all got pitched away. But so at the end of the day, I met several guys and talked to several guys, and I came home and told Karen. I said, "Yeah, I think this thing's going to amount to something, and I want to be part of it." So that's kind of the way we had kicked off. But part of the reason I had this was to elect a spokesman for the state of Kansas and or an alternate spokesman. And the guy that was elected as a spokesman was Jim Kramer from Hewitt in Kansas. He graduated from Kansas State with a degree in farm economics. Really sharp guy. And the alternate spokesman was Bill Wilkerson from, he was also out in Stanton County out there. And he'd had a big background in the grain business. He'd worked for the old Collingwood Company, which is now owned by Archer Daniel Midland. And very successful farmer, good thinker. And these guys were all good thinkers. And I guess that's kind of what impressed me that day. And we had plenty of them that weren't, but these two guys were. So that's how I got started. And it wasn't too long when they were looking for people to get out and spread the message. Well, for better or for worse, since my background was in broadcasting, I was a natural to move in and start doing some of that stuff, which I did. And I don't know, there seemed like for a while we were going somewhere two or three nights a week. I can't remember where all we went. I remember Hoisington, up by Salina, just different places all over the state. And not only me, but there were hundreds of other guys doing the same thing.
Now, did you have a title, or was this just a...
Later on, they organized. After that, they split the state up in districts. Mm-hmm. At the southwest, northwest, south central. Mm-hmm. And so, we were, in this area, we were part of the south central district. So they got together and they said, "Well, we have to elect a spokesman for this district." So I was elected to that, which was a high-paying job.
About when was that?
Well, that was still been in the fall of 77, I think.
Okay, so it was early that they actually organized it.
Yeah. But then going back to the tractor deal, the day we had this statewide meeting in Great Bend, there were two guys pulled in there with two old tractors, and they were from Texline, Texas, which is clear down up the northwest corner of Texas, about as far as you can get. And they decided they were going to drive these two old tractors clear to Washington, D.C., and they just come pulling in there, and they passed the hat to get some money, and they did drive them back there. So they were the original
in 1977,
all in 1977.
And it was just the two of them?
Just two of them.
All the way to D.C. Nobody joined them on the way or anything?
Not that I ever knew.
Do you remember their names or anything?
No.
Okay.
And
they were from Texline, Texas.
Texline, Texas. If you haven't been to Texline, you haven't missed a lot. So then, to carry that on a little further, they decided, well, they're going to organize this tractor cadet and go to Topeka, the state capital, which they did. And I can't tell you how many went there with a huge amount of them. and they...
This is the winter of 77, 78?
This was, still would have been in the fall.
The fall, after harvest, I assume.
Yeah, well, that money was late. We're looking November, December, probably. And this stuff all kind of runs together now. Mm-hmm. But Greg Bend was kind of an organizing point. Some guys coming down northwest Kansas, guys come from straight west of here, and some guys from southwest Kansas, and they all kind of piled together in Great Bend. But I can remember going up to Highway 50, we knew about what time they were coming down there, and they actually turned the kids out of school from Lewis, brought them down there in the school buses to see all these tractors come down the road, and it was a huge, huge thing. I don't know how long it took to go by. So we had probably from Lewis, there might have been six or seven guys that went and drove tractors.
And that's the first one, just at Topeka.
Right. Yeah, like I said, the fall of 77. Well, my tractor happened to be broke down, and I didn't really care because I wasn't too much interested in driving it up there. But so I think they went from like Lewis to Hutch, and then Hutch to the Emporia, and then the Emporia on up to Topeka is the way I remember it. Well, and they got up there, and they had a, you know, had a big rally who put on.
On the Capitol grounds, or?
Yeah, downtown Topeka. They had a big civic auditorium down there, but they had to park out at the fairgrounds out in the south part of Topeka. There's fairgrounds. I don't know, city, county, state. Somebody owns it out there. It's down about where that big coliseum is. So from I mean, that was the beginnings of the tractor king idea. Of course, they were getting a lot of negative press. People saying, oh, they're burning up fuel they didn't need to burn, doing this, doing that, doing something else. But that's how it got started.
You don't remember the guys from Edwards County that went?
Well, I remember Lee Boucher, Kenny Keene, Jim Titus, Bob McLean. I don't think Jeff drove a tractor. He might have gone home.
I
yeah.
I remember if he told
the next year
later.
When we went up.
Oh, there's another
year.
One. Okay.
Yeah, in 78 they did it again. But those are the guys that I can think of. And, you know, we had people that went on that thing and we never saw them again. You know, that they did their one thing and it was over. So we always had what we call a lot of silent support. We had a vocal group, and then you had a group that you wouldn't see them, but they might write a check, put money in, and everything was running on volunteer donations. And I mean, one time they had a little mini deal and went to Larned, and the people that organized that deal, they put on a free will donation barbecue, and they learned a good lesson. Farmers eat a lot, but they don't put a lot in the till when it comes back later. So, yeah, it was just some more of a learning experience.
And so they went up there that first year and they met with the state officials? Or
well,
the
I don't
federal?
Know really any officials. I'm sure there were a lot of politicians down there. I'm trying to think who was governor then. And Governor Bennett was in, I don't care if he was governor that year. I know he wasn't next year. But you know, they had a reception. Well, the thing I do remember, and I wasn't there, and I wish I had been, was Sandra Dole came out, naturally, since he was in Kansas. We had a big rally out at Forbes Air Force Base, and that might have been where they were storing all this equipment. I can't remember. But those hangars out there are huge, and I mean, it was packed. According to the guys that were there, just standing, everybody standing up, and so Dole got up and started talking to them, you know, and telling them what he thought they needed to do, and typical political rhetoric. And finally, everybody kind of booed, or the crowd was getting a little noisy, or so on and so forth. And finally, Dole, in his caustic style, which he could get that way sometime, he said, "Well, what is it you guys want me to do?" And some guy in the back hollered up, "We want you to shut up and listen." So he started listening, and he started getting the message. But that all came to me second-handed, but from more than one source on what did happen. So then, after the first of the year, when they did go back there and start flying into Washington, of course, he was the big cheerleader for the whole deal, because with the Democrats being in power, he would be a natural to be opposing to them. And he did have some good ideas, and he did listen, and he worked at it. But so anyway, in the state, each area, wherever they wanted to, they tried to organize these little local offices as a means of communication, so everybody could keep up with what's going on. At one time, they had one in Kinsley, but it didn't last as long, because there weren't that many people really that interested. And so they started one in Lewis, which we had a pretty active group over there.
Do you know where what building they used in Kinsley?
I can't remember that much thing about Kinsley, where it was.
How about Lewis? Where were you
in? Well, in Lewis, we were on the, what's now the beauty salon over there.
Behind the beauty.
Yeah. It was on the south side of what used to be the old Golden Manor restaurant. There was a little annex back there in the back that somebody just donated and said, well, here, use it, you know. And at that time, I think that the whole Home State Bank owned all that stuff, and they just said, go in there and use it. So we had to put in a telephone and all that kind of stuff. And they had a little system back then. You remember anything about the quip machines? They were kind of like a fax machine, but they called them quip. I think it was Q-U-I-P, and you had to type up something, you put it on a disc, and it rotated somewhere and sent it down the phone line, and it reproduced on the other end. So that was their main source of communication, rather than getting on the phone and running a big phone bill.
So the donations paid for the phone and
Yeah, there weren't any dues. And the whole basic premise of what they started with, that people have been paying money into farm organizations forever and not seeing any results. And we're tired of paying dues, we're tired of doing this, we're tired of doing that. We're tired of electing guys that get on expense accounts and they don't represent us. So number one premise was, all right, we're not having this as a dues paying organization. It's going to run on volunteer money. We're not electing any official officers. Part of the logic was behind that, if you had a structured organization, then somebody could file legal action against you. So they decided, well, we'll just keep it informal. Who you going to sue, you know? I guess you could pick out somebody, but that was kind of the logic behind it. And it went that way a long time, and then finally along about late 79 or 80, they decided they needed to have a more of a structured type thing, and they did it. Well, actually, they called them national spokesmen. There was never really a president or anything.
Now, at first you weren't real active. What did the other farmers think about the Edwards County farmers that became active in this? Pro or con?
Well, it's like anything else, that when you start getting into that kind of a deal, you're going to have negatives and positives. And it kind of depended a lot in the areas. Like Kingman County was a real successful area down there. But they had a lot of big farmers, well-known farmers, that jumped on the bandwagon real quick, you know, and the rest of them kind of like sheep following along. So a lot of it depended on who was involved and what their reputation was, and there was a lot of controversy over the whole thing, you know, carrying clear back to the Ku Klux Klan days, you know. People were just leery of an organization that they couldn't put their hands on or wrap their arms around. And most guys, if they had a cattle operation, they didn't have time to go out, run up and down the road on a tractor, you know, and they didn't want to, and I don't blame them. So a lot of it had to do with the people involved, who they were, what they were, where they were from, and support varied all over the state. but mainly western Kansas, central Kansas, southwest Kansas, and to some extent northwest Kansas never was involved. An area that was pretty strong was up at A's. Father Andrew Gottschalk, who grew up at Hayes, that's a common name around there, was a Catholic priest. Well, he was a Catholic rural life director in the state of Colorado. And he got involved real early on, which helped a lot, because he was a great spokesman, entertaining speaker. I mean, he jumped right in and did everything with everybody. And
one time we thought we were going to get thrown in jail in Topeka. And this cop, unbeknownst to him, started bossing Father Andy around, and everybody came to rescue and said, you know, back off, you're dealing with a Catholic priest here. Which he had his little cap on, but you couldn't see his collar. He loved that deal.
Did the Catholic Church, this was his mission at that time? I mean, they said the church was behind him?
Well, as a Catholic rural life director in Colorado, I can't, you know, say that he was being backed by the Catholic Church, but that was his job, be involved in rural agriculture in Colorado.
Hmm.
And he died several years back. He had blood cancer, but he was a great guy.
I saw him on one of the tapes.
Yeah. Really a great guy. And, you know, I mean, there were some church congregations, I suppose, were supporting, some that weren't, but anytime you do something that's out of the mainstream, you're going to get that kind of feedback.
How did the other members of your family or Karen's family feel about you guys being involved?
I don't think Karen's mom or dad were, you know, they were basically impartial. My dad, personally, was not supportive of anything I was doing. You know, he thought it was just farmer's belly aching. And so we had a little discussion a time or two about it, but I basically just plowed ahead.
Okay, so you were organizing everything. We were in 77. They got into 78. They went up to Topeka twice then? Just to Topeka or just one time?
I don't know. They went to 77. 78. They had started formulating the idea that they were going to drive these tractors clear to Washington, D.C. And the main organizer of that was a man named Gerald McCatherine from Hereford, Texas.
Can you spell that or not?
Yeah. M-A, or M-C-C-A-T-H-E-R-E-N. Gerald is a very intelligent guy, and I think I gave you one of those books that he wrote, or a couple of them. He had been active, as a lot of these guys had, in the National Farmers Organization, and they had evolved back in the 1960s, and their whole idea was to have a holding action, hold grain off the market, livestock off the market, so on and so forth. Try to negotiate a price, and it was successful, probably more in Iowa than anywhere else, because that's where they were headquartered. And so a lot of the guys that were involved in that were involved in the startup of this American agriculture movement, which Gerald was involved in that in real heavy. And there was some action here in this county, but at that time I was living in Phoenix, so I didn't know much about what was going on or what happened. And they had some success, and they were pretty much nationwide. They were clear into California. And as a guy that I knew in California, he was a rice farmer, and he told me, he said, "Well, you know, we finally negotiated a deal with one of these big grain companies to sell them some rice, and we got it done." Well, in a week they called back and said, "We want some more." He said, "We didn't have any more to sell them." So if you can't be a reliable supplier, you're not going to go anywhere. But in Iowa and up in that area, they got a wedge in the corn market particularly. And I'm not sure they're even active anymore. I haven't heard anything about them for a long time. National Farmers Organization.
That was the name of it? National Farmers
Organization. National Farmers Organization.
NFO.
NFO, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so they were involved in the Topeka one? Is that what we were
talking about? No, okay. Just what I'm saying is a lot of the background
that
fit in and the ideas that they had fit in with this movement. I like the NFO. They always started their meetings with a flag salute and a prayer. Well, that carried right into the American agriculture movement. No matter how small or where it was, they always started a meeting with a flag salute and a prayer. That's one of the things that carried over. I mean, that's minor, I guess, but it was part of it, what they did.
So the second time they went to Topeka, again, it was just to go to Topeka, and did you say the same thing they'd done in 77,
okay.
Just rattling cages again? Or?
The idea at Topeka was, when they decided they were going to make this trip to Washington, D.C., was to get the tractors from Kansas or Colorado or wherever they wanted to come from to come into Topeka and leave them there.
Oh.
The people wanted to go on. And then when they started to Washington, D.C., the tractors were already in Topeka, so that meant they were right on I-70 and they could start going eastbound. We didn't have a tractor in there. We had a trailer and went along as a support vehicle. But
what,
the thing that,
what kind of a trailer?
Oh, we just had a little travel trailer.
A travel trailer.
20-some
okay.
feet, you know. But the thing in Topeka that year got a little bit out of control. There was a guy in Nebraska named Stan DeBoer. He was a pretty good orator, but he was a cage rattler, I call him.
What? How do you spell his last name?
DeBoer, I think it was.
Okay.
DeBoer. Capital D E and then BOER.
Mm-hmm.
His name will be in that book in there
okay.
somewhere. And they had a big turnout up there, a lot of people, and when this thing was over.
Is this in December or November of 78?
It was in the fall.
Oh, it was in the fall, okay.
Yeah, late fall.
78, before the trip in 7, right before the trip
in
79.
Right. 78, let's see, I'm having trouble getting my chronological order going, Yeah. So, anyway, when this thing was over there, the streets were full of tractors. We met down at the fairgrounds down there, and the police department was well-versed on where they wanted everybody to go and what they wanted them to do. And so you're supposed to be following their orders. And I did take a tractor that time. So when the thing was over, it got a little bit disorganized, and I think a few guys ended up in jail. But so basically, they left the tractors there, and then when they decided to go on back to Washington, D.C., why? Like I said, this was a staging area. They went down I-70, which Kansas cooperated. They had the Highway Patrol out and everything. But when they got to Missouri, they were met by the National Guard at I-70, and the governor of Missouri said, "You're not going down I-70 through Missouri."
Okay, now how many tractors left Topeka?
I have no idea.
I mean, 5, 20?
No,
50?
It had been in the hundreds.
In the hundreds,
500, 600. Maybe more than that.
And what was the speed they could travel?
Well, basically, you're looking, you know, a tractor in road gear, you can go 20 miles an hour, but it's not the most advisable thing to do. See, I think some of this material here, it says they could make 100 miles a day. Well, most of the time they were doing more than 100 miles a day, depending on the weather conditions.
Did they stay on one side of the
highway? Yeah, to the right, yeah. And, of course, being on I-70, it's four lane. But like I said, when they got to Kansas City, and they just said, "You're not going down I-70. The governor of Missouri said that. So they routed everybody off on Highway 50. And so basically, as I remember, that first day they drove from Topeka to Sedalia, Missouri, which is south and east of Kansas City. And they had a big fairgrounds there, and that's where everybody gathered up. And that's actually where Karen and I started in, was in Sedalia, Missouri.
So you met with your travel trailer, you met them there?
Right. Mm-hmm. And out of our group in South Central Kansas, we had three in our bunch from Lewis. There were several guys from Pratt,
can't remember how many tractors they had, at least two or three tractors from that Kingman area. But, you know, I mean, to move this much stuff, and even if you had a little local group, like Lester Durley took a truck and he hauled the fuel, and so that was his job, you know, keeping fueled up and stay with him. Well, if you're driving in a truck all day, following that line of tractors, you're not a whole lot of fun about that. But there are a lot of funny things.
Who else went? Well, you want to give us the names of them?
In our group, there was Karen and I and Jim and Gene Titus, Deb and Kara Stapleton, Ed and Marge Schiffer, and Beverly Snyder. I think that's about our little nucleus of right closer.
Mm-hmm. Did Rocky go?
Pardon? No, he was...
Okay. Do you remember?
So that was our group. But you can imagine getting this stuff strung out on the road every day. And probably going down Highway 50 was one of the best things that happened to him, because it was amazing. They were letting kids out of school. People were standing on overpasses. The kids were waving flags, and it was just an awesome sight. So from Sedalia, near as I can remember, we went to a little town called Washington, Missouri, which would be southeast of St. Louis. And if there was a stop between those two, I can't remember where it was, but, you know, we just parked up on the side of a hill somewhere out there. But a lot of these places, if they knew we were coming, like the Chamber of Commerce or the JCs or anybody, might put on a soup supper, have some entertainment, or do whatever. And
was it pretty routine that things broke down?
You know, I can't remember a whole lot about anything breaking down. Now, some of these guys were driving some real old tractors. There were two guys from out here at Plains, Kansas, had a pair of old W9 Internationals, which hadn't been made since the middle 1950s. And they had some old cabs on there, and they drove those things all the way back there. And I'm sure there were some things that broke down. Well, Jack Wolf, I forgot about Jack, he was wrong. And he had a travel trailer, and they got sideswiped somewhere going out of St. Louis. And damaged the treader, so they got behind, but so we go to Washington, to St. Louis, and then we're in Illinois. In Illinois, the Highway Patrol was pretty cooperative, and they helped us along there.
You're still on Highway 50?
Through Missouri. We got back into Illinois, we got back on Highway 7, I-70. After we got clear around to St. Louis, mm-hmm. I guess we had to go around that bypass, because that thing kind of merges there. There's two ways you can go around through town, and I'm sure they sent us around the north route, which takes you clear around the north side and hooks back into I-70. So the guy had to let them back on there so they could cross the river and everything. Well, the next town up the road that we were going to stay was Greenville, Illinois. And they had a big local fairgrounds there. So what Karen and I were doing, we were staying out in front of this thing, kind of going ahead and seeing where we were going to park at night and what kind of organization it was going to take. Because it was hard to get across to these people what was coming until they saw it happen. But we got to Greenville, I mean, before dark, but it started snowing. And it snowed and it snowed and it snowed. So they had a big racetrack there around this fairgrounds, and we just lined up everything as best we could and went clear around that racetrack. I can't remember once, twice, how many times it was. But the JCs there, they came down and they put on a soup supper for us and brought in a band and all kinds of stuff. So every night they'd get together and they kind of go over what happened the night or the day before or that day, and kind of what the program was laid out for the next day. And I can't remember. We must have been there maybe 2 days, maybe longer than that.
Because of the snow.
Yeah, because you just couldn't get out on the road with that much stuff, and they're trying to clear roads off. But some of those pictures you got there, you'll see me doing an interview with a helicopter news crew out of St. Louis. They flew them out there. And so when we got ready to leave Greenville, we'd be going into Indiana. And I think the next stop was Terre Haute, Indiana, but I'm not really certain. But as soon as we hit the Indiana state line, and we got no cooperation from the governor and the highway patrol, from anybody. You were on your own.
Did it depend on whether the governor of the state was Democratic or Republican? Did you know that?
That could have a lot to do with it. Did you know Indiana is home of Purdue University, Earl L. Betts, and, you know, they think they got all the answers. So when we left Greenville, Steve Close, who was from Colorado, was kind of one of the guys that was keeping things in order. I need to back up a little bit, because basically we had three routes. Gerald McCatherine, who was the organizer, was on the southern route. These guys left basically out of Lubbock, Texas, and they went clear over to Atlanta and then up. Okay, then our group, which was formed out of Colorado and Kansas, and as we went that way. And then we had a northern group, which was guys from South Dakota, North Dakota, and Nebraska. And they converged with us in Columbus, Ohio. So we had actually three routes going on for a while.
And did you pick up people along, either on your route, pick up people along
some
the way?
Some places we picked up a few. Mainly after we got pretty much, we picked up some in Illinois. We might have picked up a few in Ohio. I just can't remember, it so long ago. But there, a guy I got acquainted with in Ohio, and he had reserved the state fairgrounds at Columbus, Ohio, and they had everything organized, all we had to do there. But backing up then, when we left Greenville, Steve Close said, well, you know, I gotta have somebody get out in front of this thing and start lining up places for us to stay at night, because they had to organize some of these spots. But he said, I don't know what we're gonna do when we get to Indianapolis. We couldn't find anything there. So he said, I want you to go ahead and see what you can find, you know, keep in touch. Back then, nobody had cell phones, but a lot of these guys had mobile phones, you know, farm mobile phones, and run on business band, that kind of stuff. And he said, I'll keep giving you contacts, or you call this number, and we'll talk. So we left Greenville, and we started on up I-70. And I don't ever remember staying in Indiana till we got to Indianapolis. We went up there and we started looking. Well, you go talk to people and they couldn't even fathom what was coming. So the first place we went to was like a county fairgrounds. And somehow or another I got over with some guy and he was on the fair board, and he said, well, yeah, I can show you all we got. Well, he wasn't enthused about the whole deal. He's a real best Purdue educated farmer. He wasn't too much in support of what we were trying to do. He wasn't very that much interested in letting us park there. And he said, well, there's always the Indianapolis Raceway.
Yeah.
So we go out and drive around, and we finally find this. Well, this thing's locked up tight. You can't do anything. So I think we spent the night. And I get to talk to some guy, and he said, well, there's a place out here that's, it's also called the Indianapolis Raceway, but I think it was Indianapolis Raceway Park. And he says, it's a pretty good sized facility, and they have, you know, like stock car races and drag races and all this kind of stuff. It's out on the edge of town, and it's a big, wide open area. So he told me how to get there, and we go out there. But this time it's trying to snow again, or was snowing again. And I find this guy that owned this thing. Try to explain to him what's coming and how many of them there's going to be, which you never knew one day or the next. And he said, this was evidently was on Friday or so, and he said, I'm supposed to have races out here tomorrow. And he said, you can see what that track looks like. He said, you got anybody that have any kind of equipment that would take the snow off this track? And I said, as a matter of fact, we do. We had two guys that had big four-wheel drive tractors with dozer blades on the front. He said, if you'll clean that snow off that thing so I can have my races, you can park anywhere you want to park.
And I said, that's a deal. So that's what we did. We pulled in there, and the guys cleaned off their stuff. And I don't remember how many days we were there. We stuck in there a couple of days, maybe longer than that. So that's kind of what you run up, what you ran into. So from there, then we went to, not too far from Indianapolis, Columbus, Ohio. That's the next place I can remember going. So we go on out there, and I had a contact there, and we just pulled our trailer in this guy's yard. He was a farmer on the edge of town. And so they put on this big rally for us at the state fairgrounds. Fed everybody, and I don't know, they had a band and all kinds of stuff. So from Columbus on, the next place I remember was Zanesville, Ohio. And I can't remember about picking that spot out apart, but there was a huge big shopping mall there. Something similar to what would be Town West in Wichita, even maybe bigger than that. So we decided, well, that's going to be it. So we just started pulling in there and going around it as far as we could get on the outside. I don't know how many times we lapped that thing. We stayed all night there.
No, let me interrupt you. When you're staying all night, did everybody stay in travel trailers that they brought, or did they stay in motels?
A lot of people were staying in motels, but most guys, if they had a tractor in the deal, they either had somebody traveling with them that had a trailer or knew where they were going to stay. And I'm sure there were a lot of people staying in motels.
How many acres or whatever would it take to house you at night? You know, what kind of a space were you needing?
Oh, I couldn't even start to project that. You know, if you went down here to South Park and you started over on Niles and went forward to Airport Road, and you got Neville Grandstand down to the football field, we could probably lap that thing in there three times, maybe four times, bumper to bumper.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, then there might be a whole pile out in the middle. You know, everybody always...
So you were sort of like the kind of stumble wagons.
Everybody asked, well, how many vehicles, how many this, how many that? Well, nobody knew but the CIA and the Secret Service, and I guarantee you they could have pinpointed down to a natural area. Because they had the eye in the sky watching what we were doing all the time. And they had a count on everything. A lot of guys didn't think that. The second year we went back there on another deal, and I talked to some of these guys, and they said, oh yeah, we knew right when you left your driveway.
I wonder where the Freedom of Information Act, if that's old enough to get in their files now.
But we got to be friends with a lot of those guys who were, you know, when you get back here in Washington, D.C., the mall is operated by the park police, you know. Well, then you had the Capitol Hill police, and then you had the Washington, D.C. Metro. But we got to be friends with a lot of those guys. They're all been retired from years ago, but they gave us a lot of information. So, back to Zanesville, Ohio. We left Zanesville, and I get my geography. And we went out of Ohio.
And you're on I-70 now, all this time.
Yeah, okay. I-70 all the way. We go into West Virginia. And I can't remember the name of this town, but there was a college there, and they wanted us to stop and kind of put on a little program, which we did. I cannot think of the name of that place to
it
say.
It was in West Virginia, though.
Yeah.
Morgantown?
Huh?
Morgantown?
Yeah.
That's up there.
I tried to look that up the other day, and I couldn't find it. But anyway, we were there. We got there fairly early in the day and did this little program, so on and so forth. So when this thing's over, they said, well, you know, you got to get this junk out of here. You can't leave all this stuff on me. Overnight, so Steve Close, who I mentioned earlier, and Gene Schroeder, who was one of the original organizers, and another guy in Southwest Kansas, and I, we start figuring out where we're going to try to go with all this stuff. So somebody said, well, there's a ski run up here. It's got a lot of room, and you can go up there. So we get in the van, and we go up this road, going up this ski lift, and I start looking at the road, and they're looking at the road, and everybody said, oh, man. you know, getting up there is one thing, but turning all that junk around and getting back on the road is going to be something else. So we mixed that out. Well, by this time, they're starting down the road, and we had to come up with some ideas. So on down the highway, there was some other little college town, and somewhere or another we got permission to pull in there and just park on this campus. I mean, there was stuff everywhere. Side streets, main streets, parking lots of the college. They said, yeah, you can park here or not, but you got to be out of here by X number of time, hour in the morning, because we got to have room for our students. So the next morning, everybody's trying to get out of there. It's still snowing again. Everybody's slipping and sliding all over the place. Some guy had to pull me and my trailer up out of there. Well, since we had to move out, or got here in the dark, we had to move out early in the morning. Nobody had had time to fuel up their tractors, or they didn't take time, one or the other. So we get out on I-70 again, and I talked to this highway patrolman, and I said, you know, we're going to have a big problem here pretty soon. He said, what do you mean? And I said, well, a lot of these guys didn't get these tractors fueled last night. And I said, they're going to start running out of fuel if you do not let us stop and fuel this stuff up. And I said, you think you got a log jam now? You're really going to have one, you know. And he agreed. He said, all right, you stay with me, and we're going to find a place here pretty soon. Finally, there's a huge, long hill. I don't know. It's been 2 or 3 miles to get to the top of it. And he said, tell your guys, who's ever had a CB radio, and he said, tell your guys, start moving everything as far to the right as they can get and stop. So we put the word out, as far right as you can get to stop. Well, then they let the fuel trucks come up right as close as they could get the tractor, and they started fueling all these tractors that got them full.
Around the hill.
Yeah, going up that hill. So, but this time everybody's getting out and they're fussing, they're fighting, they're growling, they're going on, arguing and so on and so forth. So I told Steve, I said, you know, I've had about all this fun I can stand. I said, I'm taking my trailer and my wife and we're going toward Washington, D.C. So that's what we did. We got out in front of the thing and let them worry about it. So when they got outside of Washington, D.C., they stopped in Frederick, Maryland, which north of D.C., probably 50 miles, maybe 60 miles. And through some contacts we had back there already, they had arranged for everybody to park on this guy's farm, which the farms back there and farms out here are a little bit different in size, but they got all that stuff piled in there. And they sat out there several days, but we went on down and we had a trailer park picked out, which was on the Beltway, clear out on the north side of D.C., which actually was in Maryland, wasn't it? It's called Cherry Hill. And so we all stayed out there. There had been a lot of people, they didn't know where they were going. They were just going, you know. And that's where we were at when we got this 20 inches of snow and locked everybody down.
But that was after we went into the...
Yeah, we had already been here a while. So that's the basics of getting to where we got to. But so we were making friends like all the way along with these highway patrolmen. And it was amazing how many of these kids that grew up on a farm, you know, and couldn't stay there because there wasn't nothing to take over for the family. But and several of them had been cops in Washington, D.C., so they started telling the brains about which streets they needed to go in on to create a major traffic jam, and they told them, well, okay, you want to get on Wisconsin with one bunch, and you want to go over to so-and-so with another bunch. Of course, the whole city's laid out like spokes in a wheel, and they created a major traffic jam.
So, now, how did you meet up? When did you meet up with the other two?
Okay, the guys that came on the... like I said, the northern route, Nebraska, South Dakota, North Dakota, they gathered up with us in Columbus, Ohio.
When did you meet up with the southern?
Okay, those guys ended up out in Manassas Park, which is southwest Washington, D.C., out in Virginia, where they had the Battle of Bull Run, and I don't know what all. That's They had a big campground out there. Well, it wasn't quite big enough, but they got them all in there. So they had this strategical meeting, George Bush would say, the night before they decided they're going to invade Capitol Hill, and laid out who was going to go in on what streets and do what, so on and so forth. So then the next morning they started the movement into the city, and it sure did shut the traffic down big time.
And by now, by this time, when you're all gathering up about it, how big is, how many tractors are?
There's been estimates of 6,000, 7,000, 8,000 between vehicles, tractors, so on and so forth. And I couldn't really put a handle on how many there was, but it was a big, well, I mean, it stretched basically from the reflecting pool at the foot of the Capitol clear down to, what, 14th Street, was it? But what happened, the cops had their strategy too. So the next morning when everybody's down there circling the Capitol and running all over the place, then the idea was they were going to have this big rally up on the Capitol steps, and it was cold. I mean, it was nasty cold. So they put all of this stuff, or most of it, tractors and stuff, on all the place you could put it without tying up all the traffic on Pennsylvania Avenue and everywhere else was in the mall area. So everybody parked their stuff on the inside of the mall while they're having this big rally up on the steps. The Metropolitan Police and the D.C. Capitol Police started bringing in every trash truck, every piece of equipment they could find, and started parking it bumper to bumper. And they basically impounded everybody that was in there. Now, our group from Lewis, they got out of there early somewhere or another. And so their stuff there was impounded. And they found their way back out where we were staying out there. But, so then they had us in there. They didn't know what to do with us. But they, the people who were there, we weren't down there either. And, you know, it just, from then on, it just was a logistical nightmare.
How far was it from where, like you said, that Lewis went out to where they stayed to go into the mall? Was it,
okay, well, that'd be on the outside of the Beltway. I'm guessing probably 15, 20 miles out here. It was quite a ways.
So all these other, most of the group was trapped?
Yeah, I mean, everybody wanted to be down there where the action was. Well, a lot of these guys, if they didn't have a tractor, even if they did, a lot of them were staying in public campgrounds like, you know, there's one crap, Northeast Washington, probably Maryland, I can't remember the name of it. A lot of those guys were parked out there. I mean, they were scattered every which way.
Tractors that
they had? Yeah, there were some tractors that were having to be on the outside, and when they started pinning them in, and there were like four or five of them down by the USDA building on the side of the street, and they sat down there for a long time. And finally one day the cops said, all right, either you're getting them out of here today or we're hauling them off somewhere. And they did impound a lot of stuff. So we kind of talked it over and we thought, well, rather than have it impounded and pay a fine for getting it out of there, we're better off. And they opened the thing up and we let it go in on the mall. And so they were there, I don't know actually how many weeks, and finally they had enough and they said, okay, today you're leaving. Anything that's not out of here is going to be towed and impounded, and you're going to be paying a penalty for getting it out. So, but this time, the guys that had been up there, I mean, a lot of these farmers, that was their program. I want to drive, I want to go up there, I want to do my thing, and when I get there, I don't know what to do. They weren't big on going out and tromping the hill lobbying, and that's what they wanted everybody to be doing, but a lot of them weren't cut out for that, you know. And so they were ready to go home anyway. So in the meantime, since everybody was down there, we decided we should be there too. They'd let you in, but they wouldn't let you out. So we took our trailer down there and we parked it on the mall. And you know, if you had to empty your holding tank, they popped the manhole cover open and let you drain it out there. I guess we carried in a lot of that, I don't know what we did. Because we were, you know, eating off-site most of the time, everything mm-hmm. anyway, but, I mean, something was going on all the time, and like I said, most of those cops were real friendly, but that's their job, is being a cop, so things got a little quiet. A lot of these guys were getting antsy and didn't know what to do and trying to figure out something that sparked their interest. And so we had a little gathering of three or four of us. We're trying to figure out something to create some excitement, get these guys back in the ballgame. I said, who has one of those big fat nylon tow ropes? Well, of course somebody did. I said, well, tonight when things settle down about 10:30, 11 o'clock, if they let us run the tractors around on the inside, I said, let's go down there where one of those vehicles is blocking a street, which you can cross that mall several places. Hook on to wherever it is, yank it out of place, and kick some tractors out on the street. I have to take credit for this. Man, I thought it was a great idea. Those cops had never seen one of those big fat tow ropes like that. So I don't know how many of them got out, maybe five, six, maybe seven, I don't know. I mean, they hooked on one of them big buses and they just yanked it sideways, pulled it right out of that parking hole. And out on the street they were. And they were going up Capitol Hill, toward the Capitol, before those cops even knew what was happening. Of course, everybody's getting a big laugh out of them, and they rounded them up real quick and took them back down there, and the cops were all saying, how'd you guys get that bus out of there? We said, it's farmer engineering. So that was some of the humorous stuff that happened. But
yeah,
snow. Yeah, then we had this huge snow. Well, we actually had that before we were down there. I mean, the 20 inches, and all of a sudden we went from being the enemy to being the friends, because in this little bunch of paper I got here, nobody could do anything, and they were hauling doctors and nurses to hospitals and tractors. They even took these big ones with the blades out to the National Airport and had them cleaning off runways. They were donating blood. They were, farm women were cooking meals in places. And after that, we'd redeemed ourselves a little bit big. So, like I said, at that time, Senator DeDole was a farmer's friend, and he put together this legislation that was going to solve all of our problems. And so when they started having hearings on it, I mean, everybody gave hours of testimony. I mean, we gave the testimony, get it, we'd had it done. I mean, just every committee was having some kind of a hearing. Guys are going in there and testifying. And we had some sharp guys. I mean, we put together a lot of good stuff, but we found out real quick that you didn't want to hear it out the other one. But the one thing I can remember was, I think there were four or five of us. And we put this deal together on export grain. And that's when Congressman Sebelius was still a congressman. And he was chairing the hearing, so we get in there. And we had this one kid from Northwest Kansas named Ron Chase. And Ron had graduated with a PhD in statistics, I think from Kansas State. But I mean, if there was ever a stereotypical looking farmer, Ron was it. He had one of them old black and white Mackinac coats on, an old cap with the ear flopper sticking out like that. And we go in there and sit down, and Sebelius, he's beaming from one ear to the other because all these young gentlemen were from his district in Kansas. And I mean, there was press all over the place. They were standing around the wall and everything. So finally he says, Dr. Chase, would you like to begin now? People go, huh? This guy's a PhD. Dr. Chase, I'll never forget that. So, I mean, that was the whole gist of the thing, was trying to provide some factual information and some motivation.
And I don't think we really said, what exactly were you asking for?
Well, at that
parity is a word.
Well, yeah, you know, and nobody knew what parity was.
Right,
and,
so
you know,
tell us about that.
What they're trying to do is, you know, was trying to get the price of agricultural products in par with the cost of production plus a reasonable profit. All right, first thing, the USDA publishes, and I think they still do, a monthly parity index where they compare prices for everything you can think of, milk, mohair, well, and so on and so forth. They've been doing this. You know, the original parity was based on it. 4 years from 1910 to 1914, as I remember. And the reason they picked that period of time was because it was a time of economic stability, no inflation, so on and so forth. So they used that as the gauge. Well, then, from then on, well, they, I mean, you go look it up today, well, even the price of grain that we got today, based on the price of input costs, would not be anywhere close to probably 70, 80, 90% of parity. But the other thing we were trying to do was get a hook to that parity index, saying, you know, everybody's been raising this stuff for years under the cost of production. And I printed this off. You can look at it later on, but they had five basic points that they were looking at. And it all had to do with what they felt like was necessary for agriculture to stay in a profitable production situation. And of course, the part about the strike thing, which got a lot of people upset right off the bat, was the deal with the strike was, they said, well, it's simple. You don't buy, you don't sell, you don't raise anything. Well, when you start looking at that ain't going to last too long. The first thing your banker says, no, you're not going to raise anything, that means you won't be paying on your note this year. Or your landlord says, you're not going to raise me a crop, I'll rent it to somebody else. Well, the buy, don't sell, well, the bottom line there was, you know, your local retail merchant, he's not the problem. And you got to consider your bank as a retail merchant. So that, you know, was a little bit far-fetched. But it got a lot of attention. You know, a lot of attention. And they did. A lot of places they'd go in and pick it, and boy, that'd shut down stuff. Amarillo and Lubbock, Texas was a hot area. They stopped trains down there. They did a little bit of everything.
Is this so that goods couldn't get in and out?
Just mainly to make a statement, you know. And the union guys, they're not going to cross the picket line. I mean, one of the funniest things that ever happened, the guy from Kingman, he was a trucker in the wintertime, and he hauled wholesale groceries and stuff out of a big warehouse down in Wichita on a railroad siding. So when they started having this idea about, you know, putting these picket lines up, it wouldn't last more than 20 minutes, most likely. So he says, I'll go down and talk to manager of this warehouse. And he goes and talks to him and tells him what they want to do. And the guy says, that's no problem. He'll call the press out and we'll say we're shutting it down and honoring the farmer strike and all this stuff. So they get a group of guys together and they go down there. They got their little picket signs and everything. But this will happen today. They go down there. The fellow they made all the arrangements with was not working that day. So here these guys show up, and this manager comes out and says, well, what are you doing here? What do you want? And they said, well, we want you to shut this place down. And the guy says, you got to be kidding. And this one guy says, do we look like we're kidding? And he said, nope. So in the meantime, guys are going around on the side of the building where the railroad track was with their little picket signs. The train pulls in on the siding and is going to unload produce. Conductor, engineer, somebody steps out and says, what's going on here? And he says, well, we're having a little holding action. And they said, well, we're not crossing this picket line. And they just stopped right there, you know. After probably got it all straightened out. Got it going. So I guess the bottom line is, did do some good? Yeah, it did some good because it had some effect on farm life legislation down the road. It made the public more aware of what some of the problems were. And we all learned a lot about how Washington, D.C. works. A whole lot.
Now, how long were you in Karen there?
We actually stayed. We went up there about 3 months, yeah, with the end of
it. Now, did I see some pictures? Did your kids join you?
They did.
But they weren't on the whole trip.
They just went there on spring break. But, like I said, when the big surge is over, and they cleared them off the mall. It's time the farmers go home. You know, those guys in the south, they start planting early down there, so they were wanting to get back and get things going. And but I mean, something was going to keep going on every day. So we had a little office set up there, not too far from the Capitol, and there were some people stayed there around the clock. Well, Karen started working over there, helping out, and then I started helping out. Every few days, there'd be more people leave, more people leave, more people leave. But we were still having meetings at the Department of Agriculture. We met at the Federal Reserve Bank one time. So there was something going on. And, you know, you build up a rapport with all these legislative aides, because they're the ones that, they write the bills. They know what's going on. They go to committee meetings. They come in and tell the congressman or the senator, okay, here's what's going on. Here's the way I think you ought to vote. Like Senator Dole's top ag aide, he told me one time, he said, I never know what he's going to do. He told me how he's going to vote, and I've seen him go on the floor and turn around and vote the opposite direction. So he said, this is the way it works. He said, everything they're doing around here during the daytime is basically for show. In the evening, things get quiet, they get on the telephone, and that's what they decide they're going to do the next day. And that's the way it runs. For better or for worse.
And so no legislation actually came out of
the... Senator Dole got this thing on the floor, and it got voted down. And they let us, they let groups of us go in, take turns going in. Well, they were having a hearing, I mean, actually, the debate, so on, back and forth on the thing. What he had designed with it, it would have worked all right, but basically what it did was it hooked production to a price support. The more land you laid out, the higher the price support was on what you'd raised. Well, the thing that everybody needs to understand is that you're knocking heads with some multinational corporations that are buying and selling them grains and also handling all your input products. I'm talking about big players like Cargill, Bunge, Continental Grain. These people have sophisticated, at that time even sophisticated, ways of telling, you know, what production is going to be, not just the United States but worldwide. They got their finger on everything. Well, they don't really care what the price of grain is, because all they do is deal in volume. And the more they deal in it, the better they like it. So anything you come up with that's going to slow down production and cut the volume, they're opposed to. Even today, that's somewhat there. But and then you got the Chicago Board of Trade. I mean, they're dealing in volume. So you got a huge lobby up there that it has to do with agribusiness. And they have influence, you know. We're getting fewer and fewer farm state congressmen. I remember the first time I ever went up there, I was sitting in Congressman Sebelius's office, and four or five of us in there, and the phone rang. And he said, just a minute, I got to take this call. And we sat there not knowing who he was talking to or what he was talking about. And when he got done, he says, well, guys, I just want to let you know how this system works. He said, that was Congressman Barbara Jordan. She's a big black lady, as I remember. I don't know, she represents some district in New York City, I think. Or Houston, one.
Texas.
Yeah, Houston, I was. And he said, what we're talking about there, she said she'd support my farm legislation as long as I supported her eradication program in the slums of whatever town it was she was representing. He said, that's the way it works. And that's the way it works. So, even today, when they're talking about the agriculture budget being so large and they keep wanting to chop it, the biggest percentage of it has to do with food stamps and that type of program more than what agriculture has involved. And there's plenty of money gets wasted, believe me. There is, and I think the thing is probably antiquated, the system that they've run under for several years. In a way, it's fair because everybody said, well, we got these multi-million dollar farmers are drawing in this money. Well, the multi-million dollar farmers did not write the farm program. They didn't design the thing. and they're not responsible. Well, the bigger you are and the more you operate, the more money you're going to get. It's that simple. But they do have a cap, too. You can't go with the cap, and I don't even know what it is anymore. But there hasn't been a farm law that was ever written that somebody hadn't been able to figure out or get around it. After being on the FSA committee for 6 years or whatever it was, I can vouch for that.
What's that, F?
Farm Service Administration now, which used to be, you know, they used to call it the ASCS, Agriculture Stabilization, so on and so forth. Can't remember the name of it now. But they changed it to Farm Service Administration. Back in the 80s, they introduced the Paperwork Reduction Act when computers came in, which was going to do away with all this paper. And those girls down there got more paper than they ever had. Didn't last.
So, how do you feel about having gone on the tractor kid? Was it a worthwhile project?
It was a great experience because as one guy said, I went back there worried about my farm. I came home worried about my country. I mean, definitely the experience you had of learning how the system operates up there. You know, it's just scary. Really scary. There are so many people in so many Mickey Mouse jobs doing so many things. And well, one thing that we were pioneers in was developing ethanol or alcohol fuel, which came a year or so later than that. But, you know, they weren't people interested in that. But we made a friend at the Department of Energy who was in there when Carter was in, named Bill Holmberg. And he was a professional bureaucrat, but he got really pumped up on the idea of alcohol fuel and what it could do and how it would cut down on the use of petroleum fuel. And I don't know. I doubt if he's in there anymore because they changed the administrations, but he held a... he could do anything he wanted to, but he had a deal down there one day and a huge press turned out. I had four or five of us sitting up there on a panel and he was fielding questions, you know, about renewable energy, alcohol fuel, and how we keep coming back every year and keep renewing it and all that kind of stuff. So we did. We learned a lot, and we met a lot of good people, and we met a lot of flaky ones too.
How did the people, when you came home, what was your reaction to the people?
You know, it went from everything from people crossing the street because they didn't want to talk to you, on down to getting patted on the back, you know. And if you watch some of those videotapes and stuff, I mean, we all know what the news does. You know, it's the old man biting the dog deal. And they were going after the sensational stuff. The stuff about hauling the nurses to the hospital and clearing the airport runways and donating blood and all that stuff never made the news because that wasn't too exciting. So, you know, overall, I'd say in this part of the country here, I'd say we had, you know, good response. But it varied from one part of the state to the other and one state to another. There were actually two kids from Klamath Fall, Oregon, that drove tractors all the way down there. And one of my college friends was from Klamath Fall, and he knew these guys. So it'll be debated forever whether it did good or didn't do good. But in the overall analysis, I think if we hadn't have done something like that, we'd have never seen some of the changes we have today. But that's my impression anyway.
You got the tractors on by trailering them?
Well, what happened, most of the guys, like Crawford Barber, who was the international harvester dealer in Greensburg, I mean, he was supportive from day one. He actually sent a track back there to haul them home. I think three was the most you could get on a truck, and that's what we had in our group was three. But then coming back, like I said, you know, a lot of those states like Indiana, man, they were tough. They didn't want us there, and they didn't care whether we came back to there on the way
back.
So
some people drove the tractors back?
No, not from our area, they didn't. I mean, it was too far to drive back. But some of them left them back there. Those guys I was talking about, those little W9 Internationals, they took them out to a guy's farm out in Virginia, and they're still sitting there as far as I know. And Gerald McCatherin's tractor, who's in this article here, his actually got put in the Smithsonian. And it was there for years and years and years, and a couple years ago, for some unknown reason, they took it out. We tried to promote leaving it in there, but it just didn't happen. But it was down there. I can't think of that. That building was something about industrial and something else. It was on the north side of the mall. I just can't remember the name of it. But yeah, a lot of them left them back there.
I think I read that some, a couple of them got burned or something.
Oh, there was more.
How many got burned?
Cotton pickers got burned. I don't know, that picture in there by the Worthington Monument, there was one got on fire down there. Yeah, there were some crazy things happen. I'll have Karen tell you about going to the White House. They let us out of there one day to go to the White House, and she got to drive a tractor down there.
What was I going to say? Well, I am not from here, and I do not remember this from southern Michigan, although there may have been farmers that joined you. I don't know.
Yeah, we did.
And as a child of the 60s, as a protest, I found it amazing that farmers stood up and protested in this way. Was that a reaction?
I think it was.
Because farmers are usually pretty conservative.
Yeah.
It's
a buildup over a long period of time. You know, like Father Andy, you know, he advocated day one. He said, you know, we don't want violence. He said, we want non-violent action. Well, my term for it was constructive harassment. But never at once did he ever advocate nonviolent action. But, I mean, there were certain areas of the country like Georgia, those guys down there, they did stuff that was so innovative, I can't remember all of it. Well, the way they got started, a guy from out here at Plains, Kansas, they just called out there at Springfield and they said, we want somebody down there to tell us about this deal. So they flew him down there, and this guy named Tommy Kersey, he was a fireball. He had a couple of three brothers. He picked him up to the airport, and they put on a big meeting on several thousand people there. And Gene explained what's going on and what the deal was. And he got up, told his story, and sat down, and this Tommy Kersey gets up, and he says, well, you all heard what the man said. Are you for him or against him? If you're for him, stand up. Well, he's not going to stand up, you know. Yeah, man, they did stuff that was wild. Nobody ever got hurt or anything. But backing up a little ways, we knew all the time that people pretty well knew, especially these produce growers, that we had all these restrictions put on produce grown in the United States. Can't use this herbicide, this insecticide, so on and so forth. And these guys knew it, coming across the border all the time. And it's repackaged in boxes and produce at Texas, blah, blah, blah. And the stuff that we couldn't use here was being used over there.
New Mexico, you're talking?
Yeah, right. So, I mean, like tomatoes, and mm-hmm. I can't remember what else. So, there was a group of them decided they'd go down there to McAllen, Texas, which is on the Texas mm-hmm. medical border, and protest this thing. Well, they got down there. There was a big farmer named Ortho Bryan, I think it is, in that book of Gerald McCatherine's. But they're going to shut this thing down. Well, they found out he was kingpin of the area, and a bunch of them ended up in jail. Mm-hmm. But it did spotlight it. And another thing we found out was the United States Department of Agriculture was putting canned beef into school lunchrooms, and right on the can it said product of Bolivia or Nicaragua or somewhere. And we said, is this right? You know, American beef producers getting shortchanged by the United States Department of Agriculture. So we got that one stopped. But I'm sure there's still plenty of produce coming in. It's got that stuff on there. But that goes back again to that lobby. So anyway, they threw a bunch of these guys in jail. Well, Tommy Kersey's brother was one of them. He goes down there and he tells this guy, he said, y'all got about 15 minutes to get my brother out of that jail. And if he had napped, his tractor's going right through that door of that police station. Well, they negotiated a deal and got them out, but there was a bunch of guys who got beat up, tear gas, and I don't know what all.
So there were plenty of heads that got knocked. I mean, that happened back around the mall. Some of them were asking for it, and they got it. You know, they're only going to tolerate so much. This one cop told me, he said, you know, I come off a farm up in Pennsylvania. How'd you like to have a job where you report every morning knowing you're going to have to deal with the scum of the earth? But he told me about the riots during the Vietnam War area. Mm-hmm. He said, I had fish hooks thrown at me. He said, stuff you can't even imagine. So when they spoke, you better pay attention to what they told you.
Is there anything else that you've left out you'd like to...
Oh, we can talk for hours, but, you know, that's kind of the general gist of the deal. Only thing I just...
The guy was coming to stay until he got done. I can't remember the story.
Yeah, Arkansas had a real active organization, and they did a lot of stuff. But anyway, there's this guy who's a big rice farmer, but he was also a lay Baptist preacher. And his famous line was, told his wife, I'm going up there to Washington. Or pack me two pair of underwear, I might be up there for a week or something like that. Well, I mean, he could get a crowd riled up in her.
What was his name?
Otis Chapman. Yeah, unfortunately, he went broke, but he was a great guy. But, like I said, we went there to a convention one time when Clinton was still the governor of Arkansas. It's the first time I'd ever met him or been around him. He is definitely a charismatic personality, he was at that time, and he backed these guys, but I mean, he was buying them 100%. Of course, when he got elected president, they thought, well, we'll never see another bad day. Guess what? They couldn't even get close to the White House. A lot of them were on a first-name basis with him. But another funny story about Otis, there were so many of these congressmen, even though they were from agriculture state, didn't have the foggiest brainy idea about agriculture. So Otis goes in at the congressman's office, and the guy welcomes him in to sit down, and he says, how's your spaghetti crop doing this year? Otis said, it did real good till the alligators ate it all.
But most of the people credit, they were willing to listen, but up to a point until they got overly saturated. But another old congressman from Texas, I think he was a congressman. Yeah, I didn't make any difference. Named Pogue. And I was in his hearing. Senator Dole got me in there. I just had to stand by the door, and I asked him if he'd get me in. He said, yeah, come on. And he just led me by the arm in there. And so they were going on about all this stuff. And this old man says, you know, he said, I represent a pretty big agricultural district in Texas, and I have not heard anything from one farmer in my district about this problem. He shouldn't have never said that. Because all these guys in Texas that I knew, there's a lot of them, they were also sitting around the wall like this, and I could see them all start looking at one another. Well, somewhere or another, they got his unlisted telephone number. And he started hearing some farmers in Texas. And about 2 days after that, Karen and I were over in that, I think it was that Longworth office building, and we turned the corner to go down toward where his office was just by accident. I mean, their hall was jammed with guys, and here's these mail carts, one after the other, just stacked up there full of mail bags. He was hearing some farmers from Texas were getting in touch with him. So you had to be careful what you said or what they said, or some of them made any difference.
Did this experience affect how active you have been since then in farm?
Oh, you know, I never was much of a joiner. I did, this friend of mine, Bill Wilkerson, I was talking about earlier, he was real active in the Kansas Association of Wheat Growers. And I belonged to that for a while. I went to a national convention one time in Minneapolis, Minnesota, but historically, farm organizations, you know, they they get kind of entrenched, and they got a pecking order, and it just kind of becomes more of a fraternal thing than anything else.
What happened to the AAM?
Well, they kind of quietly died down and rode off into the sunset. They got really involved in 80 on this alcohol fuel thing and started promoting that and biomass energy and a lot of that stuff. And really what derailed them, like I said, when it got past the point of driving a tractor down the road, there were so many of these guys were lost when it actually went up there, and you had to beat the hull and try to present your case. And with any group, you start getting splinter groups. And we attracted every splinter organization you could think of, you know, right-wing ideas. And most of them are just wanting to ride on their shirt tails. But they got all involved in thinking the Federal Reserve ought to be restructured. Well, lots of luck with that one. And then they got all involved with the currency's going to crash and everybody needs to buy gold and silver. And just a lot of right-wing screwball ideas that didn't make any sense. And kind of got them off the beaten path. And old Father Andy said from day one, you know, we don't want to get identified with the far right, far left. We want to stay with what we got going here. And so, you know, over time, it was a movement. Movements die out. You know, and there's still a core group that gets together every once in a while, but the influence they had at one time is pretty well gone.
So that organization still sort of exists.
Yeah, they have a structure. Mm-hmm. A young guy from down here, Haven, he's still the president of it. But and then once a year they have a get-together over here at Stafford. That was just a couple of weeks ago, I think. You know, they just get together and talk about old memories and stuff, which is great. I haven't been to one of them for a long time. And they kind of have a national get-together once a year in Oklahoma City, and we haven't been for probably 3 or 4 years. But the thing is, I'm 76. A lot of those people we knew and associated with are gone, you know, unfortunately. But we have one good friend that we hear from usually at Christmas. And Tom Benson, who lives up in Minnesota, Appleton, Minnesota. His dad was a governor of the state of Minnesota, and then he was also a U.S. senator. So Tom grew up in Washington, D.C., and he knew his way around it. He was a big asset, sharp thinker. I mean, really good thinker. And Tom's going to be in his mid-80s probably now. But anyway, I mean, you know, not to discredit anybody, there were a lot of really intelligent people with some good ideas, did a lot of things. Bud Bittner from Wallace, Colorado, he taught school. Unfortunately, he got killed in a wreck working on one of these alcohol stills to make ethanol with. Not drinking alcohol, but yeah, there was, you know, some really guys, good ideas, good thinkers, smart people.
Well, any other thoughts you want to wind up with?
No, not really. You know, if you just want the tractor take kind of business, I mean, it was exciting and everything. Like I said, when people got done with it and they didn't know what to do. And going up and beating that hill is work. I mean, you can walk yourself to death up there. And some places you get response, some places you don't. Some places they want to talk to you. But very few of them have an agriculture aid. Farm state congressmen usually have an agriculture aid. If you go and talk to somebody from downtown Chicago, they're not going to have an ag aid. But they'll have somebody, excuse me, usually they'll listen to what you have to say. But unless you've been up there and see how that thing works, you can't believe the amount of people that go in and out of those offices every day. It's just, I mean, everybody's there beating their own little drum for something.
Okay.
Well, as somebody used to say, oh yeah, that was Jim Cramer's line. He said, Washington, D.C. does not act. They only react, and they only react to the current crisis. We got a crisis in agriculture. That's what he used to say.
That's a good place.
So what came along and afterwards when on this alcohol fuel thing? Well, in the early 80s when Reagan got in and went through the financial wreck and guys couldn't get loans and all that stuff, we probably had as good an effect right then as we did any other time because you know, we were saying it's coming, believe me, it's coming, and guess what, it's here, you know. When you figure the biggest industry in the United States starts going downhill, and it's going to pull somebody else or something with it. I had a friend who lived in Washington State, and he had a fertilizer business, and he thought we were nuts, you know, the stuff we were doing, everything. And we went up there to visit him in the 80s. And he said, oh, man, everything's good up here. You know, we grow potatoes, we grow apples, we grow walnuts. I said, believe me, you're going to find out one of these days. It may not be this year, it may not be the year after, but you will find out. He did. He went broke. The farmer owed him so much money, he had to fold it. But he couldn't understand what we were doing or trying to do.
Okay.